Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 46 featuring Norman Seeff. If you don't know who Norman Seeff is, I highly recommend you look him up. Seeff is spelled S-E-E-F-F, and he is a photographer, to say the least. He has photographed some of the most amazing people in the world, and he does that and captures some incredible emotions throughout his photography. Go to the podcast page itself, which is at labs.chaosgroup.com, and then click on podcasts and you'll see this podcast listed. Go there and you can see some other examples of his images, or go to his website, which is normanseeff.com. So if you've ever seen like the famous photograph of Steve Jobs, then that's Norman Seeff. If you've ever seen the famous photograph of Ray Charles, that's Norman Seeff. So incredible, incredible guy. I met him at THU. This is another part of our THU series. Immediately I met him, I started hearing what he had to say. I had a selfish reason that I wanted to talk to him on the podcast. I knew that I wanted to get his interpretation about the Uncanny Valley. So this podcast starts off with me explaining to him, he doesn't know anything about CG or in terms of what all of that is. So I had to explain to him what the Uncanny Valley is. So a lot of the beginning is me explaining that to him and then his reaction to that. If you don't know what the Uncanny Valley is, again, go to the podcast page and there'll be a graph there that explains exactly what it is as well. And we talk about that graph specifically on the podcast. He is has an amazing way of talking about what he does. And his photography is really about bringing out someone's character and their mood and emotions throughout there. And when he looked at and talked about what we're doing with the Uncanny Valley, he's saying, you know, what's missing is probably the idea of consciousness. And he talks about the idea that we may perceive of things that we don't understand when someone is alive and we know they're missing when we see them dead in this case. And he explains that story. But then actually, I explained to him a story that I think I've told a couple of times on this podcast. But the person who inspired that story is here with me. Stephen Parker, go ahead. Tell me about what you... why you gave me this idea about that.
I didn't realize that I gave you the idea, but I think you are probably referring to the blood flow research that we were looking into for digital doubles.
Yep.
And in particular, a paper out of MIT, which was labeled kind of weird. I think it was video magnification, and it basically had to do with, there was a process for it. Amplifying small changes in motion or color, which I believed was a next step in what we were doing, just, you know, in terms of making these things believable,
right?
In trying to introduce very subtle aspects to a life form, basically.
Right. So that thing of blood flow is very, very subtle, but you believe that we perceive this unconsciously or subconsciously, right?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, and even the motion itself. I mean, I think
like eye motion.
Yeah, the various, you know, eye motion, which if you know, you have a fast enough camera, you can see it's quite a bit.
It does move quite a bit
more than you ever realize, because you get accustomed to it and you expect it, but you don't really pay
attention to it. And if it's not there, you know that it's
missing. You know the absence of it.
So that's the thing, I think, that's amazing to me, is that, you know, the way that Norman describes seeing the difference between someone being alive and someone being dead is that those things stop, right? Blood flow stops, eye motion stops, all that stops. And that person, clearly, he knows that person is no longer conscious, and therefore falls into this awkward moment, and that may be the things that may be missing in the Uncanny Valley. So it's a really a fascinating talk we had with him. He actually didn't have that much time with us. He said he only had about 40 minutes, but the conversation went on and on, and you'll notice halfway through I interrupt and I say, we're already at a certain time, but he kept talking. So it ended up being quite a long podcast, which generally means we got into a really good conversation. One last thing, there's actually going to be a follow-up podcast the week after this, which is what we did with Oleg Alexander. Actually, Stephen and I were both on that, which is a response to this specific podcast from the more scientific point of view, why we think certain things are possible and where an artist's needs to step in and where a scientist needs to look at the data differently. So it's a good follow-up to this one. So stay tuned to, so let's just call it the response to the Norman Seif podcast. All right, guys, hope you enjoy it.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the chaos group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
This is a podcast.
For your company?
For my company.
Right. And you're recording already?
Yes, I'm recording already.
Yeah.
And it's a conversation. It's fine. What we do is we put it out once a week.
Right.
And I have about 7,000 to 10,000 listeners a week, so it's pretty successful.
And the listeners are all people in the design
artist
side or on the tech side?
Both.
Yeah.
Both. And it's what our rendering software does is it does photorealistic rendering. Mm-hmm. So we're basically like a digital camera in a sense, if you think of it that way.
Right.
What we do in our software is we define what the materiality of things are. So what, you know, what this table is or what this, the surface of this looks, the color, textures, et cetera.
Right.
And then we place lights and we do a rendering of it. And the computer traces the rays of light and figures out how it's supposed to look.
Right. From you become a lighting director.
Exactly.
Right.
And so the people who use our software typically in the visual effects field are called lighters.
Yeah. So that's great. We can go, well, should we light from the front so that there's no bags under her eyes?
Exactly.
Or from the side?
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. So we define sort of materiality of how things look.
Right.
The goal is photorealism, right? Which is why it's used in visual effects.
Right.
Because, you know, you want a car to move, et cetera, et cetera. And it has to look correct. And it's been getting unbelievably good. Actually, our primary, believe it or not, our primary client, the ones that really sort of gave us our rise, is the architecture field.
Hmm.
So architectural rendering now has become unbelievably photorealistic that it looks like digital photography.
Right.
So that's kind of the idea. And we see how much light bounces off of things and where, and et cetera, et cetera.
So can your rendering actually be in movement? So you'll render a frame and then you can literally do...
We render frame after frame. And we even include the motion blur. So we clean the time that it takes so it'll smear across the frame as well.
So is the motion... part of it, something you develop, or you use another app for whatever?
We use another application for that. So all the animation and the modeling and everything else happens in the other application, and then we take that information and send it to our software.
Right.
Our software we place the lights in another application, but then our software understands that that's a light and represents it as such.
Right.
So it's a pretty interesting field. I've done it for many, many years.
Right. So your company, the source of the company was where?
Was in Bulgaria.
Okay. So and then it became now a multi-continental operation.
Yeah. Two guys in Bulgaria who are very good friends of mine started this. It was one very, very smart guys. One is really good about trying to figure out how to turn this business and make it really interesting. The other person is a brilliant programmer.
Okay.
And they sort of created this company. And it was I knew them when it was just two guys. And now we're almost 200.
Now, how would you come across them?
I was an artist.
You were an artist.
I was an architect. And I used it in architecture. I knew from the very beginning that this was going to change the way that we looked at rendering in architecture.
You see, that's really interesting. As a practitioner, you could have the perspective of, because you know, in the process of doing your work, it would be amazing if.
Right.
So from that point of view, you could actually have a recognition of what the value of this would be.
Yes.
In a real life situation.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's I do see the value of it. When I worked in visual effects for a while.
Yeah.
And I did a bunch of things. And when I left to work for this company, I wanted to make something that was about my own ideas. In visual effects, I'm creating images for someone else's vision.
Right.
Which is great and fun, and especially if that vision is great and fun. You know, when I was working on Tron, it was a lot of fun.
Mm.
You know, the light bike sequence was something I really enjoyed doing, and I loved, you know, figuring out those interesting problems, like how to make the glass on the floor look beautiful and how to make the bike look like it was moving fast, even though there's no sense of, you know, anything in the scene. So those were things I loved, but it wasn't my vision. It was, you know, art directors and the director.
Yeah, you were packaging someone else's dream.
Right.
Right.
So what we're doing now is I came to the company as a creative director, and then I quickly moved into this new role called I'm the director of Chaos Group Labs. Right. We're doing these lab projects. And one of the things that fascinated me when I was in visual effects is digital humans. You know, when we recreate humans. And a lot of people freak out when you talk about digital humans.
Mm.
There's a very big problem with them. And that problem is that they look... I actually have a graph I can show you.
Oh, that would be great.
Here. This was actually the original version of this graph was made for robotics.
Right.
So the idea here is, the idea here is that when something, this is familiarity and this is human likeliness.
Right.
So when you start off with an industrial robot, it's, you know, it's not familiar, but as you start to make it more humanoid, it goes here. If it starts to look too close to human, but not human enough, it falls into this valley here. And this valley here is called the uncanny valley, where the familiarity looks bad and kind of scary. And that's when they say corpse or zombie here. And then this is supposed to be a robot in motion. And this is supposed to be a static thing. And then it comes out of that valley once it starts to look like a healthy person again. And this has been used in films quite a bit. So here's the steps example. Not very human-like.
Right.
And then here, this is Toy Story, where they look very close to human, but we know they're not human. So they're not scary.
Right.
And then the example that everyone always uses for the Uncanny Valley is Polar Express, the movie Polar Express. Everyone was freaked out by the way these people looked. Tom Hanks looked like a zombie, even though it was no intention of it. It was too close to human.
Hmm.
And then in this example, this is Tintin. People felt that it was starting to come out of the valley, but still, we know this is not a human. The last example, and this is my pinnacle example, I think is the best representation. This is Benjamin Buttons. This is a completely synthetic human.
Hmm.
Most people didn't know that it was a synthetic human. The first third of the movie is a completely synthetic human.
Wow.
And so that's kind of something that's really important. So this is sort of... represents that graph.
Now, where did this graph come from? Was that something that's like standard-wise for the business, or is this a concept that you were like playing with?
Yeah. No, this is a standard of the business. In fact, it is adapted from this graph here, the original one. This was actually developed by a professor in Japan who was doing it when he's studying specifically things about robotics.
Right.
So that's kind of the idea there.
Mm.
So... what I did is I got a group of people that are studying digital humans in different ways. People that are writing the software to figure out exactly how the skin reacts to light, the subsurface scattering we call it, or the way that we can see all the micro detail inside of the skin. We go down to 10 microns of information on the skin and scan that information in. And we look at all this scientifically speaking, right? And then I also got a bunch of artists who have a passion for digital humans and have their take on this situation. And people that are studying the Uncanny Valley itself. There's people who, you know, doing it as getting their PhDs on this. And I want to get all of their opinions and package it and put it out there. So the idea was we're going to take as scientific information as possible to remove as much of the variables of what is causing the problem. Because the problem is, oftentimes when you see something that's a synthetic human, we know it's wrong, but we don't know why it's wrong. And we all know it's wrong. And the reason we do is that our children.
So you're telling me you're not a synthetic humanoid right now.
I'm not a synthetic humanoid.
To the real deal.
You're talking to the real deal. Exactly. And so we all know it's wrong because there's something about the way that our faces react that that is interesting. And the reason I think it is, well, a lot of people sort of agree with me on this. Babies, right out of the womb, my daughter was born. She stared into my eyes. First thing she decided to study was a human face. Mm. And we know this from children. Babies stare at human faces all day long. They study the human. So it is the most, it's the thing that all humans are experts on is the human face. We know this. Mm. And I know that you look at the face and you're looking at things when you photograph things, that you're looking at this face and you're trying to find that thing, trying to find a response. And everything that you do is about action reaction between you and your photo, the people you photograph. I can see it. I saw your presentations. I totally understood what you're doing. But if you're not getting the right response, it creates the sense of repulsion in a sense. And I believe, as an example, I think that there's a relationship between the uncanny valley and autism. Where an autistic person may not necessarily give you the response that you're looking for, which makes you uncomfortable.
Right.
And so when I saw what you were doing and how you were photographing things, you find the exact moments to capture an emotion right. and put it on print. And like immediately you feel sympathy and empathy and joy and sadness when you see this person, which removes all sense of distance that you get from that person.
Right. Well, you see, that's a very important thing that you're bringing up now, because the distancing, that sense of alienation or separation, mm-hmm. Is a very big source of pain in the human condition when people feel distant from each other. So there are two layers to what you're saying as I look at what you're introducing me to. And it's fascinating, by the way, because interestingly enough, I'm known as a photographer. I'm less known as a filmmaker, but I've been actually a filmmaker for the last 25 years. And the reason why no one knows is that I've been shooting these sessions, filming sessions with across the board creators and innovators, renowned directors, actors, writers, sports people, politicians, and using the fact that they were, I was commissioned to do a cover for a magazine or an album cover in the early days. Mm-hmm. So I was commissioned to do a session. But what I realized, each session was in fact a 3.5 to 4 hour collapsing of time relationship. The idea was, if someone walks in and I'm meeting them for the first time, within 3 hours, could they be leaving where we are now intimate individuals who have a sense of knowing of each other and we love each other already, and there's almost an eternal bond between us.
Yes.
So what I realized, yes, there was a skill set of what I did, but in fact the real art form for me was the art form of creating relationship and creating an environment for a relationship to be intimate and safe and trusting. I've just had a little flu, so I get a little blocked every now and again. But so the art form, which I thought I was going to be engaged in this particular moment, you know, across a series of different careers that I've had. But this one, arriving in New York and starting from scratch with stopping people on the streets and photographing them, what I realized ultimately was every time I stopped someone who I found fascinating and I said, I want to shoot you at in your own environment, which is how I started, I was going into a 3.5 to 4 hour relationship with them. And ultimately, the art form shifted from getting the shot to can I create an authentic relationship and create authentic experience in the moment. And when you're engaged in that depth of relationship and you're in a communication where people trust you enough to let down any defenses and allow you in to the soul, as it were, that when that happens, we forget about the fact that we're taking photographs. What we become engaged in is the richness and the excitement and the discovery process of the relationship and that fascination with each other. And I'm seeing people become, you know, vitalized and excited. And, you know, when they feel seen in a genuine way and not judged and really respected and honored for who they are, they look at you in a different way. They breathe in a different way. Their shoulders relax. And so I realized that I wanted to capture images of people, what I would say, in a state of being their best selves, mm-hmm. not terrified of a camera and sucking their energy in and looking, you know, like a deer caught in the headlights.
Right.
So what I realized that I thought I was going to be exploring the discipline of photography, but I realized I'm actually exploring the nature of human relationship and the nature of human communication.
Yes.
So it was a paradigm shift, first of all, in focus. So I'm not now focusing on a goal. I'm focusing on creating authentic, spontaneous experience in the moment, which required me to be authentic in the moment. And it, what it really brought up for me was having to learn how to be in touch with my emotions as they unfolded and to be able to allow who I am being seen, because you can come to someone and say, hey, I want you to drop all your defenses, drop your defenses, here I am, and pick up a camera.
Right.
And they feel like you're taking a revolver and you're cocking the,
right.
You know, and you're saying like, relax.
Right.
what it really involved was, could I be the first one to be real and to be able to be vulnerable in the moment? I'm not talking about exposing, you know, stuff. It's just, here's who I am. Here's what's going on with me. Mm-hmm. So I actually found myself learning how to be in touch with myself. And when I use the word myself, what myself is the constant flow of emotion. And actually the way it works is there are dozens of emotions flowing at every moment. You can be scared and excited and bored and thrilled and awed and, you know, at peace and enthusiastic, all these paradoxes, they're all going on. That's what people don't understand, that we, the flow of emotion is the fuel of the creative process. And when I realize that I'm going to connect with this person, or what I want to do is I want to connect with this person emotionally, once you are able to open that doorway into the soul, as it were, then what happens for me is the relationship unfolds and I'm seeing this constant spontaneity in front of me, and I'm just documenting moment by moment. Yeah. But the reason I'm giving you the detail here is because I want to bring it back to this fascinating dynamic. How do you make a rendition of a human not look like a ghoul or some kind of synthetic wooden non-human creature?
Right.
And for me, the answer is, if you can bring the emotional experience that is real, not fake emotion, but real emotion, if you can imbue that character with genuine emotions, and I'm just bringing this up hypothetically, mm-hmm. if that level is there, maybe it's not so much about how they look, but it's how they feel. So I just want to bring up one thing which you said very interestingly today. You asked a question. I was at a conference together, and you asked the presenter if he'd ever had a good experience with clients.
Yeah.
And he was very like, well, you know, I won't use the swear word, but
yeah,
the four letter
word.
Yeah,
that's
fine. Yeah, okay. Well, fuck clients.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
And I can tell you what I went through in terms of having had seven genuine careers.
Right.
And just as for your audience, I started off as a professional soccer player.
Right.
And then moved into being a medical doctor. And then this was in South Africa, and I ran one of the emergency units in Soweto in South Africa. And then I decided to explore my creative side. And I just one day said, that's it, and packed a bag and came to New York with a camera.
But you always knew you had a creative side. You remember you said
No. I always knew from childhood because, as I said, from the age of six, I was drawing anatomically correct figures in three-dimensional rooms. Not perfectly, but good.
Right.
So it was just the visual sophistication was there. And then all the way through my childhood, between all the various influences, you know, and you're in a phase where everything is possible.
Yes.
But there was the part of me that wanted genuinely to be the healer and to work in a world where I saw so much pain and separation. And but the other side of it is that I wanted to express myself.
Mm-hmm.
But what I did finally was I said, you know what, I'm going to make that turning point, defining moment and destiny decision. And so within a week, I resigned at the hospital, got myself a one-way ticket and rolled up in New York with a camera. And, you know, the hubris of the adolescent, I was older than an adolescent,
mm-hmm.
but the adolescent energy can be there. Mm-hmm. Like, I can do anything. And I had no idea what it was going to take for me to walk into a city like New York, where there are thousands and thousands and thousands of fantastically good people in a very, very competitive environment involved in survival.
Right.
And so the romance of I'm going to be an artist, you know, very quickly evaporated because I ran out of money and I wasn't getting work, and it became about survival.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is, in the same process, how do you find your true voice as an artist? And initially I thought, well, you know, I've got this visual ability and I can make beautiful images, you know, with ease. But then I discovered, well, I'm working with people and people talk back.
Yeah.
And people have, you know, ways of being and personality drives. And I knew nothing about communicating at an emotional level. I didn't understand the emotional foundation of creativity mm-hmm. at that point. So what I found in what I call my paradigm shift, rather than trying to make a picture, was, well, if I'm going to give the imagery that I create a life to it and infuse it with the soul of the person, you can't fake it. You have to actually in some way be able to engage the person at that level.
Mm-hmm.
So what I discovered, to my horror, that meant that I had to engage me at that level.
Right.
And so it came up, well, who the hell are you? If you're like hiding your fear and you're pretending, you know, you're not scared and you're trying to act like you've got your shit together when you don't, that's a lie. And
right.
when you're lying to yourself, you inhibit the spontaneous flow of emotion. So slowly I had to do the work where I had to look at all the beliefs that I held about emotions. This one is good and this one is bad and this one is macho and this one is weak, and go, you know what, if I'm going to be real, I have to drop all of that and I have to allow the truth of who I am. And so that took a period of about 5 years.
Mm.
Now I'm making beautiful pictures, but I'm going through a personal nightmare because I'm terrified every time I'm working with people because I'm not being real. And I told the story the other night, and I'll just repeat for here,
sure,
because
yeah.
it's a kind of a turning point. One day I walked up to an artist that I was working with photographing for a project. And I said to her, you know, I have to be honest, I'm terrified. I don't know where I'm going. I don't know right now what I'm doing, but I know where I want to get with you.
Mm-hmm.
And to my surprise, rather than, you know, her laughing at me in humiliation, she said, thank you so much for saying that. I'm terrified too.
Right.
Now, who would have known, you know, like I work with a lot of public personalities
sure.
and they all look like they're in a spontaneous ease with themselves.
Right.
Not true. But this was a revelation for me. You know, my life goes in epiphanies of revelations, as it does everyone.
Sure.
So that first revelation was, hey, the creative act is there is a skill set that you need to learn. Yeah, absolutely. You want to be a guitarist? You need to really understand how to play a guitar. You need to do the skill set work. You can't go, oh, I'm just going to be expressive and not have a skill set. That's kind of a sort of indulgent hubris.
Sure.
So there's a skill set to learn. But ultimately, what you have to do, when I say this, I'm talking about what I learned that I had to do, is I had to infuse something of myself in the artwork. In other words, put who I am, the soul of me, the essence of me. I have to infuse that with my truth. And the way that that would happen was if I'm emotionally in touch with what's going on, I'm actually bringing myself so I you can take technique and infuse it with emotion, and then it becomes art because someone else looking at it can sense the emotional authenticity in it.
Right.
And if I wanted images of people to have that power and strength, I had to be able to create a relationship where they are in a state of emotional authenticity with me. So the art form became the art form of creating relationship, and I would say emotion-based communication. And then can I create an environment where they feel safe enough to be real? And that safety was created by me being real as the first one. So this is just the backdrop to where I want to go with your question.
Yeah.
And I end up having a very successful career as a photographer and shooting hundreds of album covers and moving from musicians to directors and actors and writers and politicians all the way to shooting the president of the United States and governors and sports people. And what I'm looking at is this is all people at the cutting edge of their particular discipline. And I'm beginning to find that it doesn't matter what the discipline is, there are certain consistent dynamics that are there on in everyone, whether you're a scientist putting rovers up on the moon, or you're a black guitarist who is a picker of oranges in Florida and you're now one of the funk greats.
Mm-hmm.
The same conversation went down between that guy and Sir Francis Crick, who discovered the double helix.
Mm-hmm.
And so I discovered that there was an archetype that was there in the creative process. And I'm still getting to my point.
Okay.
Okay. So ultimately, I had about a 20-year career doing that and started filming my sessions because the conversations started moving towards these amazing, intimate moments with artists where the best way I can describe it, I'm not a photographer, but I use photography as a vehicle, and I'm now bringing film crews in, and I'm not a filmmaker per se, but I use the filmmaking process as a vehicle to deliver the content, the media that I want people to see, but I see myself as an explorer of the inner process of creativity.
Mm-hmm.
And why I say inner process, because creativity begins not in the physical, mechanical dimension. It begins in the mind, in the imagination, in a space of sudden conception that comes out of higher dimensional consciousness. It doesn't happen in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
It happens in the unconscious and the subconscious, and then it comes down into the mechanical components of the brain. So I realized that we're talking about something that's outside of time space. Creation happens outside of time space in a concept, and then artists have to bring concept into reality, as we were talking the other night.
Mm-hmm.
So all of this is going on, and I've now redefined my voice as an explorer of creativity from the inside out. But how do you take what you experience and feel inside and turn it into a realization in a tangible way? And then I get offered an opportunity to become a director of TV commercials. And the reason I took it at that point was I'd spent all my money on filming, you know, my sessions. Mm. And I'd spent millions of dollars, frankly. And I'm, you know, a couple of million dollars in debt.
Mm-hmm.
And an advertising agency comes to me and says, you know, we've seen your films. Your films are amazing. Could you make that happen in commercials? And I said to them, well, as long as you don't tie me down to hardcore scripts and you let me do what I do, which is about a spontaneity in the moment, yeah, I'll do it. And the company that I worked with was the most successful advertising agency at the time. Mm-hmm. And they gave me as my first commercial project a series where I ended up shooting something like 60 commercials for them, and it won every award under the sun. Mm-hmm. And I go directly from never having done it to being regarded as an A director right away. Mm-hmm. And they threw all this money at me, and I went, great, I can reimburse myself for all my own investment
right.
on my own project. But here's the way to work with clients that I discovered. So, you know, I start off, and the idea is, well, here's this guy, this is what he does. Just let him go free. And as you know, advertising is massively market researched,
right?
To its detriment, because it tries to, let's not in any way offend anybody.
Yes.
And you end up with basic mediocrity on every level. Well, at that point, it was like, let's do the most creative things we can do. And that's how it started at the time. So I start off in this way with a lot of freedom, but as the career went on, it became tighter and tighter. And unfortunately, the artists and the writers gave their power away to the account executives. So ultimately, when I started, the writer and the art director were presenting what they did to the clients.
Yep. I used to work in commercials as well.
halfway through my 10, 15-year career, mm-hmm. The writers and directors have been pushed aside, and the account executives are going there. And whatever the client was saying, they thought the way to hold on to the project was, oh, anything you want. And they gave power away completely.
Right.
So, but the way I would work with that dilemma, because I'm going, well, everything that I do is about freedom of expression. And commercials are a very beautiful playing field. You can do beautiful art within that 30, 60-second boundary. But if the boundaries get too tight, you end up with, you know, just hard sell, and there's no soul in it. But what I do with clients, because when they would come in, they'd bring me a script. And they'd say, you know, we've spent months and months and months arguing the script, and we would argue for a day on whether there should be a comma or a full stop over there, mm-hmm. right? And so the way that I handled that was, you know, I wanted to honor the client. Mm-hmm. And so what I'd say to them is, look, okay, let's work through it, but I want to take you through your script from an emotional point of view. Mm. Why is this person saying this emotionally? You guys tell me what the emotion is. So I started to engage them to take what were those cardboard cutout lines, mm-hmm. like your cardboard cutout humanoids,
yeah.
and start to bring life into them. So they started infusing emotion into it. Mm-hmm. And then I said, okay, guys, you know, I will shoot your script, but I want you to do one thing for me. I want 5 takes where I have complete freedom to do it exactly the way I want to, and I want to work with the actors the way I want to work with it. And after that, we'll do your script. Mm-hmm. And I always negotiated that 5 takes. Mm-hmm. And I would go to my actors and I'd say, here, look at the script. Okay, give it back. Mm-hmm. And they'd get the idea, you know, actors are really good on like memorizing. And I'd say, I don't want you to remember the lines exactly. I want you to remember what they were saying. And I want you to be able to communicate with each other from an emotional point of view. Mm-hmm. And I'd shoot my 5 takes and the clients would go, oh my God, you've got it.
Right.
Right. And then I'd say, okay, you know, maybe there was one or two that said, gee, you know, and they'd tell me at that point, okay, just keep going.
Right.
And then, you know, I would go back and I would honor them and to say, look, if there's something that you'd like me to try, I'll do it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I'd shoot the script in the way that they wanted and they'd look at it and they'd go, God, this is amazing. This is dead. But the way that you did it is alive. So to come back to what you're doing.
Yeah.
And my question here is that vacuous space, that's the terminology that yeah. we use. What do you call it?
The uncanny valley.
Okay. Well, the vacuous space is because it's devoid of feeling.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So that's what the uncanny valley is.
Yes.
If you put genuine feeling in there, does it matter? You know?
Yes.
And I throw that out. I mean, the people that are doing the research on it You know, maybe they are linear thinkers and they're not thinking that in fact the juice of creativity is emotion. And for anything to be alive, it has to be feeling.
Right.
Otherwise, it's just a moving robot.
Well, part of the problem, and I know this is the tough part, is that what we're trying to look at it in a scientific way for a reason, is because it's the only thing we can measure. So how we know when there's emotion, but it's hard to define that scientifically what an emotion is.
I'm going to bust you.
Okay.
You up for that?
Oh, yes.
You cannot look at it scientifically. What you're doing is you're separating from the feeling and you're becoming, rather than a subjective experiencer, you're stepping out of the experience and you're becoming an outside observer. So this is, and why this is really important, because I came from the science world, mm-hmm. and I saw the devastation of what it does to people. And I also have seen the devastation of the chauvinistic model, the twisted masculine. Let's just do it, do it, do it, do it. And there's no feeling in there. And if you just do it, you do some stupid things.
Right.
So people actually have lost the capacity to be in touch with their feelings, because, you know, what science is about fundamentally is how can we control what's going on?
It's sure.
It's an attempt to control the world. Now, the fundamental nature of creativity is about the courage to jump into uncertainty and allow yourself to have in the moment spontaneous experience where you're not controlling it. If you try and control it, you lose any opportunity to do something new, to be an initiator of something that you've never experienced before. Now, I'm not saying that you mustn't use your intellect. There is a combination of feeling and intellect. The intellect allows you to step back and observe yourself and be the witness of your behavior. But the experience, the emotional experience, must be there first. Otherwise, you're in control. So what I was presenting the other night was, it was called, you know, creating beyond control.
Right.
People want control. There's a difference between domination control and creative control. Mm-hmm. Now, creative control, really for me, for it to be alive, means you have to be willing to dance with uncertainty and allow yourself to go through the emotional feelings. And then you can look at it and go, okay, well, what was I feeling? And was I resisting? And was that feeling rigid? Or was it expansive? Was it constricting? Was it in any way controlling the free flow of life and mm-hmm. human experience? Because I got scared at some moment and I didn't have the wherewithal to know that I was scared, or I was embarrassed about being scared, and I hid it. I hid that emotion. Mm-hmm. So when people say to me, you know, well, we want to check if meditation is real, let's do all the scientific experiments and see if we can get, you know, imagery of changes in skin, whatever, you know, all the things. And I go, well, why the fuck? Why don't you just go and try meditation? And you're not going to have to do the test to see whether it's right before you engage in it. The whole thing is that attempt to, am I doing the right thing, is complete contradiction to innovative creativity, which means you have to be willing to step into the unknown and uncertainty. And I want to bring this back, because I shot a film with the scientists and the engineers who put the rovers up on Mars.
Yes, yeah.
And I was stunned, because I went to the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, and the head of that organization, Charles Alucci, completely understood the nature of functioning with uncertainty. And one of my first questions to him was, and this is the way my film starts, is, are you comfortable with uncertainty? And he said, absolutely. He said that if you're not willing to allow yourself to be uncertain and you're not allowing yourself to be willing to fail, you set a limitation. Because as high as you want to go or as low as you want to go, if you set any limitation to what you're doing, you are not going to allow yourself the full range. So the ideal is to say, look, let me go into this without trying to mentally figure it out, subtext control it. let me be the fool on the precipice, willing to jump into uncertainty and feel my feelings, which I then go equals authenticity. If you're not willing to feel your feelings and you're trying to analyze your feelings scientifically, and I know it's not as simplistic as that. These guys are feeling guys and they're looking at that as well. Sure. But I'm talking about the classical fundamentalist scientific way of going, you know, we're going to figure out the movement of planets. And once we understand all of that, we know that we've understood the nature of reality. That's the way they thought when they worked that out. And it was hubris. Now, it is absolutely, it is the downfall of science that it's so tied into the mechanical model, because the mechanical model is the low-hanging fruit of what it is to be human. And there is a mystery to it. You know, and I, by the way, I hated even the word mystery. What do you mean mystery? I'm going to figure it out, because I came very much from that. Let me control my reality. Until I looked at it and I went, well, why do I want to control my reality? I want to control my reality because actually I'm terrified and I want to have domination control. And so I had to go through those experiences of, can I get real in the moment and actually experience the aliveness of being emotionally present first, and then I can step out of the experience and do some self-reflection. Very necessary, but it doesn't start with the mental. It starts with the emotional experience, and then step out of it, look at it for the purpose of, can I allow myself to be more free? The way I look at it is, where was I resisting? Where was I free? Where was I not being courageous? Courageous meaning willing to feel my feelings in the moment without trying to control them. Mm-hmm. Willing to act in spite of the fear. Willing to explore my highest truth, even though I don't have all the answers at this point. So what happened in, bring it back to commercials, the idea of let's go out and market research it, then the people who don't understand the very fundamental nature of innovative creativity, which is about uncertainty, are trying to make it certain.
Right.
So it's not going to work. It's my opinion, but I've seen it not work over and over again. They would come in, and I even went to some of these groups, and you could manipulate the answers any way you liked when you were doing market research,
right?
By just the tone of your voice.
Yeah.
So you know, I want to give you a chance to kind of add feedback here.
Well, it's That was kind of one of the things that I realized specifically when I heard your talk. And I know that the goal was to say, if I remove as many variables as possible by controlling as many variables as I know, or did I say I can measure, then it's going to make the process easier because it's less things that I need to control. Right. And actually that specific lesson I learned when I was taking photography classes, because in photography classes, the less I did to the camera and I just kept things working, the more I could just, you know, if you put it on aperture priority, then you don't have to mess with too much more. You know what I mean?
Right.
Those kinds of ideas. It's like, that's being controlled and I need to do only one variable. That's what I was trying to achieve by doing these scientific measurements. But the epiphany that I had was like, I can't do it. There's something I'm missing.
Yeah.
And there's a creative part that is critical. There is always a creative part. Of course there is. I think that's the thing that's important. And right now, the field specifically of digital humans is actually very competitive.
Right.
And everyone thinks they have the secret sauce.
Right.
Everyone says, the secret sauce, we have it. It's intellectual property. It's right here. No one can touch it. The fact is, the secret sauce is the artist behind the work.
Exactly. Now, the variables are not something I'm saying you mustn't try and get to where you remove the variables.
Right.
I'll give you an explanation. And then I had this incredible ongoing conversation with Charles Alachi, because I realized he understood the creative process in a very broad and a very wise way. And so he said, you know, we are a campus. There was 6,000 people working on that particular project.
Mm-hmm.
He said, we're a campus of dreamers and implementers. And, you know, I'm going, you know, gee, the Jet Propulsion Lab, they make rockets, you know, Mr. Macho rocket guy. And discovered that it was a campus of people that were into their imaginations and dreaming up. But that's the part that I said, you create it in your mind, and it's outside of time space. It's not in form. So once you conceive of the idea, how do you bring the idea into the tangible world, into the world of where you actually, you show your work?
Right.
So that's when you bring in the scientific, the algorithms and the processes of trying to be as elegant as we can and, you know, get stuff out of the way that's not a priority for what we're doing. So I'm not saying, hey, you know, let's all get into our imagination and be emotional. What I'm saying, if you want it to be alive, be willing to enter the unknown, into the mystery, into the eternal. And if you can animate, yeah, get the physical form.
Right.
But the physical form, I, as a medical doctor, I've seen a lot of physical forms with no soul in them, dead people.
Right.
You know, and it was amazing to me. I'd be working on someone in emergency and they would die on me. And there was that instant difference. Suddenly they become this lifeless piece of...
And I there's a theory I have on this. And yes, if I can share this with you, because this is something that I actually want to study. Same experience. One of the people in my group, he's actually one of a developer and an artist as well. So he's both a science and an artist. But he actually was in the war. He was in the Iraq war. And he said, I've seen a dead person. I know instantly that person's dead. Even if there's no sign of trauma, their face looks dead. You know it. It's not a person laying down, being still. And he's also a little bit scientific. And the thing that created this epiphany in him was that he saw a video done by MIT where they take an area of your skin and they, you know, while, let's say like a video of me not moving, but I'm alive, right? They take a little area of your skin and they measure in the video the slight change in color in the skin that's happening over time. And then they enhance it 100 times. And what they suddenly saw is you could see blood flow moving through someone's face, even when they're, that we don't normally perceive. But he believes we see that in our self-conscious.
We have a set of what we call familiar senses, sight, taste, temperature, all of that stuff. Human beings actually have another whole set of senses, which has not been accepted. And now people that I'm working with are beginning to more and more be able to give it a language. Mm-hmm. But these are the unfamiliar senses. And you're actually picking up frequencies of energy from people. And
even in imagery?
This is the most amazing thing. Let me give you a test that I did.
Okay.
I would bring an artist in and I'd say, okay, I'm just doing a lighting test. Would you stand right over there? Hey, guys, bring the light here, bring the light there. Just look at me. This is nothing. This is just a test. And I'd be exactly the way you are now. I'd go, okay, click. Mm-hmm. And then I would do a session and end up having this emotionally profound, intimate, caring, compassionate relationship with someone. And by the time they left, 3.5 hours later, we are hugging each other. Mm-hmm. And we know that we will always trust each other. And I would say, by the way, before you go, would you just come back here? I want to just do another shot. Let's do exactly what you did before. Mm-hmm. Same shot. Thanks a lot. I would take the first shot. I would take the last shot. Mm-hmm. And when the artist came in, I said, by the way, I want you to look at these two photographs. Tell me what you think. And they'd look at the first and they'd go, oh, God, I don't like that. Mm-hmm. And they'd look at the last one. They'd go, oh, I love that. Now, most people won't see the difference. There is absolutely an electromagnetic frequency of energy when you are working with someone and you are having an authentic emotional experience in the moment. There is an energy in a photograph, even if it's just black and white tonalities on a paper, that people can pick up. Now, you can argue whatever the point is. Mm-hmm. But I knew that when something has life in it, there is a multidimensional quality to that image. as I said the other night, I'm just photographing people against a gray background. Right. How many hundreds and hundreds of headshots can you do against a gray backdrop?
Right.
But I have people going, oh, I know that one. I love that. Oh, that's my favorite one. I love that.
Right.
It's all the same shot. But it isn't, because they were each unique emotional experiences in the moment.
Right.
Now, it's a hard one because it took me years to go, yeah, well, I think I'm feeling. And people that I was working with saying, no, you're talking about thinking about your feeling. You're not really letting go of your attempting to try and understand what you're thinking. I mean, what you're feeling. Feel first. Don't. If you're in a place where you're trying to make something happen, you're not in the moment. So the art form became, how can I learn to be in the moment genuinely without trying to control the moment or step outside of it and use words to describe it? The minute you use words to describe it, that's not it. It is it's an indefinable frequency of energy that must be there. So this little test that I did, and I did it 100 times. Mm-hmm. And I got exactly the same experience every time. I don't like that. I like that.
Yeah.
But it was the same shot. Little subtle differences when people have had an incredible experience. The shape of the eye is a little, even though they're just looking at you, their pupils are more dilated. Maybe their shoulders are down a 16th of an inch. Maybe the edge of the mouth is not pulled down as maybe it's up a little because they're having, you know, an experience of just having fun.
Mm-hmm.
So those subtleties and what I'm bringing up here as food for thought,
yeah, no,
is can you get your researchers to start to say, okay, let's first of all look at, you know, emotional experience. Are we in fact feeling our own emotions? But is there some way that we can start to work with this to and understand totally what it is? You've got to use that physical form, like expressions. I said maybe the pupils are a little bit more dilated, maybe the eye is a 16th or a 32nd slightly more open.
Mm-hmm.
Those things are physical renditions of the emotional experience. So emotional experience begins first, and then it downsteps into physical expression. Quantum physics says that reality is not there until you observe it. So what I'm saying is the quantum scientists, you know, who are trying to figure out what the hell are we actually meaning when we discover that the observer defines the way the form is created. If we observe in one way, we get one result. If we observe in another way, we get another result. So the observer is consciousness. It's not physical. And when you do scientific experiments, that's fine. The physical world does have algorithms and mathematical relationships. And if you want to take a concept from something in the mind and make it a technical, physical reality, bring in all the science, all the technicality that you want, but to give it life, you begin in the intangible. And I didn't like intangible because I was like terrified. You know, I came from a world where I felt if I wasn't in control, you know, the way I worded it was always lost. My life, you know, I had to be looking in every direction at every moment. I mean, I was working in a warfare environment.
Mm-hmm.
And it was terrifying. You walk down the street, you had to walk in the middle of the road.
Mm-hmm.
You don't use a sidewalk at that place, you know.
Mm.
So I had this intense desire to have, to understand every variable, to have absolute physical control. But, you know, my emotional stuff was a kind of an energy that would attract animals will smell your fear because it's an emotional it's a frequency. So it's a hard one for people to make that jump. You know, you can say, oh, yeah, be in your emotion. No, can you be in your emotion without saying, okay, I'm in my emotion and now I'm going to feel?
Mm-hmm.
Just let yourself be in the moment. And sometimes we do it. So we know, you know, that, wow, in that moment, I was authentic.
Yeah.
I was authentically myself. And all these other places I see, you know, well, I'm kind of half numb, or I've got blinders on, or I'm, you know, I'm saying something because I have a hidden agenda that I want to work out.
Sure. Yes.
So it's an astounding experience to start to work with emotion to be the animator of life, and then let life be a rendition, a tangible physical rendition of the true you, which is the emotional experience that you're having as a consciousness. And your body actually, you know, as I said, the scientists only got half of the equation. They said consciousness evolved out of the mud. Mm-hmm. Well, the other way to look at it is that the mud was a downstep of consciousness, which created the mud, which now turns around and comes back to consciousness. Ultimately, what I'm talking about is consciousness is the creator of everything. Mm. And if you can jump into that dimension of consciousness and deal with what I call the inner resources of creation, the same way that the tangible world has elements, you know, you look at the elemental table,
sure,
you know, calcium, magnesium, da-da-da-da-da. Well, the emotions are the elements of consciousness. And everyone has imagination and the potential to be courageous and the potential of perseverance and conviction. And we have fear and we have dread and we have hopelessness and despair and rage and love and well-being. Those are actually the elements. And so I started working with those elements and saying creativity is emerging out of the field of consciousness and is downstepping into the physical world, and we are holographically creating a body.
Yes.
And we're holographically creating this world out there. But to our senses, it looks like the world is out there, and we have nothing to do with it. But I don't know how many millions of people there are on the world. Every one of them has a unique individual hologram that they're experiencing calling reality. Mm-hmm. So in a certain sense, and this was interesting, when I was about 14, 15.
We're running about 55 minutes. I don't know if
I'll go another 5 minutes.
Okay, sure.
I had this strange feeling like we're looking at the world down the wrong way.
Yes.
Of the telescope.
Yes.
And I didn't know what that was. And only later on, as I was doing this work, I was looking at the world as if it was a physical dimension creating a conscious awareness.
Yeah, okay.
And now I look at it and go, no, it's a conscious awareness downstepping into a physical dimension. Just to give you, like, because I also think scientifically, there's new work now talking about the Big Bang. You know, the Big Bang was, well, what's behind the Big Bang? Nothing, right? Well, first of all, you can't, you know, you want to have all the answers and how can something come from nothing? But, you know, that's where scientists go a little bit blank. They go, oh, we're not going to go there. But in fact, maybe what was there was a higher dimension of consciousness, which downsteps through a Big Bang process, creating a hologram called the physical universe. Mm-hmm. And which is more real, the physical universe or the higher dimension that is more real, that is projecting a lower dimensional reality. Now, you know, this all sounds very hypothetical, but the point is that where I'm coming from now is that I am experiencing through the work that I do, especially in the meditation practices that I'm involved in. And mm-hmm. I said the other night, there are more dimensions that are experienceable in the four dimensions. You can literally, through meditation techniques, go into a dimension called the imaginal realm. Mm-hmm. And the best way to explain it that becomes completely confusing is it's a dimension where imagination imagines itself.
Okay.
Okay. Then there's another dimension, and it's the dimension of creation, where creativity creates itself. It's just emerging out of essence. And then there's another dimension, you know, where it's pure energy. So we're talking about seven-dimensional spaces again, and I look at the quantum, they talk about dark matter and multiple dimensions. And how many are there? They're 14 or 24 or whatever. Well, you know, that's great. They are onto something, but what about if you could go there and actually have an experience of what it's like to be imagining something and literally being able to drop it in to your world? But because we're in a world of time space, mm-hmm. when you open your eyes, it won't be there, but you've got more possibility if you go to the imaginal realm and do the visioning work for that reality to come into your physical dimension than if you didn't do that technique.
Yes.
So, you know, what I also said, we're in the information age. But we're now moving through what you could call the age of consciousness, where we start to make the way the world works, it created out of consciousness, not out of mud. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then beyond the age of consciousness, we now move into the age of innovation, that as we understand how we can create out of essence using the primordial energies, the inner resources of creativity, mainly emotions, and we can literally by conscious intent vision what we want and drop it into time space.
Right.
And then we can innovate. You know, this the way the story is going, this third act in my life, I don't like. Mm-hmm. I have choice, which is one of the most profound innate powers that define what human consciousness is. We have choice. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't want to have choice. No. They're screwing up my life. Let me blame them.
Right.
You know, let's blame Obama. It's right. Like, it's the favorite word in America right now. But you give your power away. The minute you blame something outside of yourself, you're basically saying, I'm not the one holding the power. They have my power. Therefore, I have to go to war with them.
Right.
What I'm saying is we all have access to all of the resources of conscious creation. And if we can just give ourselves permission, we have them, but we're mostly not willing to use them because we haven't given ourselves permission to use them. We want to blame someone else. But if we can learn what those inner resources are, and then we can use them. The next step in the discipline of being consciously aware is, what do I really want? What's my heart's desire? Not what the society is telling me I should want.
Right.
What do I want? You know, I want more love in my life. Mm-hmm. I want more intimacy. I want to be able to feel safer and be more trusting. And what I'm saying to people, everything that we're doing, frankly, comes down to not the form that we create, but the function that we're looking for behind the form. So what I'm really wanting to do as an artist is, yeah, I want people to look at my work and say, gee, that's fabulous. But actually what I want to do is to feel that incredibly ecstatic experience of creating something out of nothing. And that's where I'll use the word of nothing, because the nothing actually is not empty. It is full of the elements and the inner resources of consciousness, which are gifts that every human being has. And if we can learn, it's all there for us to use. Let's take that material and we can become the creators of our own reality. And a lot of people also don't like that. They really don't like the idea, well, what about, you know, and I don't want to go too far down this thing, what about the Holocaust? What about women mm-hmm. that are raped? Mm-hmm. And there are beautiful answers to that. But the point is that, you know, do I want to live a life where someone else is creating my reality? Hell no. Mm-hmm. Can I learn by learning to access the inner resources, specifically the emotions and the certain human powers and strengths? And then once I understand what's my heart's desire, I can consciously use those resources like an artist on a tablet and create worlds. These kids and guys and women that I'm talking now are literally creating out of their imagination worlds and people, and they're godlike in their creation. They're creating fantasy worlds. So they understand what I'm talking about intuitively, but it's really more than that. That's actually the way that we create reality. Mm. That every single person is in fact creating their own reality, that most don't know it, but you can learn to become conscious of how you do it. And so that's the work that's been fascinating to me, and why I've worked with artists, because artists know that they are the authors of their own works, mm-hmm. right? And yes. When I do these conversations and I'm saying, you know, you're the author of your own works, and finally someone puts up a hand and says, you know, what you're saying and the way you're explaining it, could it be like maybe our lives are also something we're creating? And I go, what a wonderful question. Yeah, I'm working with that one.
Right.
You know, and this is a kind of stepping stone to accepting the fact that we are creators mm-hmm. with godlike abilities.
Yep.
We have access to inner resources. We have choice. And if we can do, if the first step that we will go is let's authentically experience ourselves, and then we can step out and look at it, not with the intention of how can I control it, but let me get a perspective on why I am avoiding my fear or why I'm so enraged about this.
Right.
And when you understand the why and you can go, well, do I like that? And do I want to shift it? So once I understand the why, now I can start dealing with making shifts. But when you understand the elements of the way they work, you can literally start authoring your own reality, becoming the authors, giving yourself permission to do it. People have the ability to be authors, but don't give themselves permission, as I said, because mainly the thing that gives people a hard-on, frankly, mm-hmm. is who can I blame, which is really saying, how can I not be responsible for my own power?
Right.
So I don't know if you – I'll give you in a couple of minutes here, but if there's anything else that you want to bring up.
No, that was brilliant. I think the way that you described specifically the emotions being the elements of – consciousness is exactly the problems that I'm struggling with right now, because I'm basically trying to find the nothing that I have is a reality in my humans, right? They literally do not have the consciousness in them. They don't have the emotional part in them. And that is what I'm trying to infuse. And it can be created within our reality, just like you described. But it takes a skill set that I think is extremely specific in a way to understand how to take emotion and put it into something else.
Well, you see, that's going to come out of you.
Yes.
And that's what I did with actors. I said, okay, you've seen the line. Okay, give it back to me. I don't want you to remember the line, but remember the feeling.
Right.
And so what happened is they made – I used to have to put lines on the end of my commercials saying – these are actors, not real people.
Right.
Because they were so real when I used that approach mm-hmm. that people went, no, this can't be an actor. And I'm saying, no, these are actors.
Right.
Because once they did the script from the place of the emotional experience, mm-hmm. what was a dead two-dimensional model became a living being.
Right.
So, yeah, you're developing the skill set and the technology for giving yourself everything you need, now you can start working in a different way for yourself. How can I infuse this with emotion?
Right.
And I don't know the answer to that. You're the one who'll have to figure that one out.
I know. It's going to take years, but we'll get there.
But it's the way to bring aliveness. And can you imagine if you really get authentic emotion into – and they're there already. I mean, that's where the storytellers come in.
Right.
Because, you know, there are more people crying over the animation movies these days than almost anything.
It's true. But it's yes, they are crying because they're not in the valley yet. You know what I mean? So you can forego the feeling is there, but it's something. So I know the problems. It's hard to define right now. And I think that's part of the beauty of it is the journey is going to be a beautiful thing too. But your time has been unbelievable. I don't want to take up too much more of it because I feel guilty. But I really appreciate the opportunity we could talk and record this. And the fact that you're here has been a wonderful thing.
Well, I love the opportunity to talk at this level with people.
Yes.
So you give me a gift. I'm not just stroking you. This is, you know what, let's live our lives and communicate at this level and then do silly things as well and go for runs on the beach and all that, which I'm going to do now with my wife.
Okay.
But, you know, it's an honor for me. Absolutely.
Thank you.
And I love what you're doing here. Just
I have a lot of authentic conversations with people, and these feel really good.
And isn't that beautiful that that's becoming your voice?
Yeah.
So you're working at the company, but you're also discovering your voice, which is an explorer of ideas and the futures and the unknown and the uncertainty. You do have that ability to step into that, you know, that space of uncertainty. But the uncertainty, I used to go, space of uncertainty is a void.
Right.
And now I get, no, it's more full than this space.
Right.
It's so full of every single possibility, but you can go there and you can create anything in that space that you want. Because if you use these inner resources, we have every damn thing we want to create anything that we want. And that's frightening and why most people don't want to know. Hey, I just want to kind of live, you know, half alive with my blinders and my, my earplugs because I'm too scared of being too intense or too passionate or being laughed at or being looked at like a fool, then you miss the essence of everything. You know?
Well, thank you so much.
Okay, my pleasure.
I appreciate it.
Okay.